Okay, so Mataji is the disciple of Srila Prabhupada and has been practicing bhakti for 50 plus years. That's more than 5 decades. Mataji has a PhD in education.
If they don't know that, are you sure they're going to understand?
Mataji holds a PhD in education and master's in school administration. She is a chair of GBC Shastric Advisory Council. She is also an associate editor for the BTG magazine.
Well, I used to be for 30 years.
Oh, wow. And Mataji has extensive experience in teaching bhakti to children. She is a traveling teacher, guide, and mentor to many. So we are very fortunate to have her with us. Warmly welcome Mataji today by chanting loudly. Hari Bol!
Hari Bol!
Hari Bol!
Hari Bol!
Srila Prabhupada ki
jai! Okay, you could... Okay, if you could all do what I'm about to do and put your phone on vibrate, that would be great. Okay, so today, yes?
Sorry, just at the end, the second microphone isn't working, so if people are asking questions, maybe we might have to just move the mic around, or we could just repeat the question.
Okay. If I forget at the end, will you remind me? Okay, good. It's still a little bit of an odd angle for Zoom, but hopefully it's okay. So it's February 14, 2024. In Sydney, and we're going to first run through the Ishopanishad, and then we're going to run through the Upadeshamrita, right? Yes?
Yes.
Okay, so let's do the Ishopanishad first. And I think you have, I think you should have 3 papers on the Ishopanishad. Not a problem. Is this better?
Yes.
All righty. Is this even better?
Yes.
If it was any closer, it would knock my teeth out, so I hope that this is okay. All right, do you have the papers?
Yes.
On Ishopanishad? You should have one that looks like a chart that has an overview, and then you should have 2 more. Oh, look how nicely that was done. Who did that? You did that. Can I see how you printed it? Wow. I didn't have that border, did I? Did you add the border?
No.
You didn't. I don't think I had the border. That's nice. All right, so what we're looking at is the ones, at least for here with this Prabhu, it's not stapled. You've got this,
yes,
and then you've got this one. Great. First class. That's very enlivening. So again, we're going to be going through this extremely quickly. This is just an overview of the Ishopanishad. Have you all already studied the Ishopanishad in Bhakti Shastri? Yes? No?
Yes.
Some people are just looking at me like this. Have you studied the Ishopanishad and Bhakti Shastri, yes or no?
Yes. Yes.
Not all of us.
Not all of you. So some of you have, some of you haven't.
We will be doing it in our next
semester. Okay, we also have a book available on the Ishopanishad that's available, I think it's on Amazon. It's also... There's some room in here, Devesha. If you can let my grandson get in somehow or other. Well, not right there, then you won't be able to see the screen, but like I think on the couch. Or right there. There you go. Okay, great. Oh, that's fine. You're fine where you are, Devesha. All right. So we also have a full study guide in book form that's available. Ishwar Prabhu has published it. I think it might also be on Amazon. And we use a lot of these graphics in the book. Okay, so this is organized. Maybe we can turn off some of the lights here. Okay, you need. I need some light on me, though.
The other one.
I only need light on me because it's being... Yeah, there we go. Because otherwise the people on Zoom can't see me. Okay, so here we've divided the Ishopanishad up into vision, guidelines, and prayers. So vision, you can see, is in the invocation, mantras 1 through 3, 4 and 5, and 6 and 8. And guidelines are in 9 through 11, 13 through 14, and then prayers in 13 through 14. And sorry, 15 through 16 and 17 through 18. Again, you can. We have a book online that you can get that has all of this, what you have in the paper, plus much extended with exercises, a short book. And you see the difference here. We have guidelines for knowledge, guidelines for practice, prayers for knowledge, prayers for practice, foundation of knowledge, practice for living entities, knowledge of the Supreme Person, knowledge and practice of spiritual vision. Okay, so looking at the foundation of knowledge, right? That was that one section, and practice for living entities. So in the invocation, we have that the absolute truth is the source of everything. Do you all know the invocation by heart? Everybody should know this, yes? Can we say it together? Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnat Udachate Purnasya Purnam Adayam Purnam Eva Vasishtate. Now, the literal meaning is simply, this is complete, that is complete. From the complete comes. If you take the complete away from the complete, still the complete remains. That's a literal translation. Did you all get that? I'll say you can repeat. This is complete, that is complete.
This is complete, that is complete.
From the complete comes.
From the complete comes.
If you take the complete away from the complete.
If you take the complete away from the complete.
Still the complete remains.
Still the complete remains.
So that's a literal, that's not the way Prabhupada translates it. That's a literal translation. And Prabhupada talks there in the purport about Krishna being the Brahman, the Paramatma, and the Bhagavan. And all complete as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. He also talks about the spiritual energy, the material energy, and the marginal energy. And that in all these ways, Krishna is complete. Now, then we have the next verses, mantras 1, 2, and 3, that we should, how do we practice this completeness? We understand that we have our quota, that we will be taken care of. We take only what's ours. That's actually a very deep and important verse. You could say that this mantra one is the essence of an honest life. And violation of mantra one is the essence of criminality. If I take something that's not my quota, I am stealing. Right? Now that's the essence of it. I'm more extreme. I'm raping. I'm murdering. Murdering, I'm taking your life. Raping, I'm taking your body. It's some kind of taking. It's taking that which the other living being doesn't want to give. Taking something that doesn't belong to me. Now, on a very minor, everyday level, this means I'm taking your time and energy that you don't want to give. I'm trying to push you or guilt trip you or force you or manipulate you into giving me something that you don't actually want to give, that you're not giving willingly. I'm trying to take something that's not mine. And this can work on a very subtle level. I mean, even if I say sometimes, okay, I have to go now, I have to go to sleep. Oh, Urmila, can I ask you just one more question? And I'll say, it's 10 o'clock at night. But can I ask you just... That's stealing. Do you follow? Yes? Someone trying to take something by force that I don't actually want to give. We don't think of that as, but that's what it is. Anytime that we try to manipulate or guilt trip or force somebody to do something that they don't want to do. Now, I'm not talking about little children that you have to train or that you can't leave alone in the house. That's not what I'm talking about. I don't want to go to the store. Sorry, I'm not leaving you home alone. You have to go to the store. But that's something else. That's a different category. But someone needs to be muted. But I don't think we think about it like that. You know, what is actually my quota? And when we know it's our quota, then we can deal with other people with utmost respect. Then in Mantra 2 and Mantra 3, it's what happens when you do it, what happens when you don't do it. Huh? I don't know. It's not such a great projector. So we'll just go back in. If I follow this, then I will be happy, and if I don't follow it, I will be unhappy. And I follow it with the philosophy that everything's complete. That I have what I don't have to take from your quota because I already have access to the complete. I can be satisfied with what I'm getting because I know that I'm in touch with the complete whole. That's how that philosophy translates into practice. All right. Let's look at this in terms of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Not everything is on your paper that's in the PowerPoint. There's more in the PowerPoint than what's on your paper. And if there's things in our book that are neither on your paper nor in the PowerPoint. So if you do want to get the book, I think it's like $10 or something. Online short book. Okay, if we look at this in terms of Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana, what do I understand? I understand Krishna's complete, and I'm only going to be complete, feel complete if I'm connected with him. If I'm disconnected with him, I'm not going to feel complete. I'm going to feel that there's some kind of lack. I can only feel complete when I'm connected with the complete. What do? I accept my quota. I accept what I attain through honest work by the grace of God. Which is, of course, connected to Varnashram. Right? We have our book. I'm sorry, we've run out of books. But we have our book, Career Dharma, How to Understand What is Your Nature. And people say, well, if I work according to my nature, I won't make enough money. I hear that a lot. But the idea is that we do what's our natural work, and whatever we get as a result, whoever has the power to mute people on Zoom needs to do that. Whatever I get as a result of my natural work, whatever honest livelihood I get, I accept that, and I'm satisfied with that. I don't try to do something outside of my nature or outside of what's honest. Yes? And if I do that, I will attain everlasting life. I will attain eternal life if I'm actually just satisfied with my quota. And here we have a whole summary. Would someone like to read this? Any volunteer to read this?
Personality of Godhead is absolutely complete and perfect. Everything and everyone is coming from him, yet he remains an absolute whole. And therefore, everything is controlled and owned by him. One who understands this truth will only take what they need and use everything in Krishna's service. Knowing everything belongs to Krishna, and in that way, they live an everlasting life, unbound by material energy. However, if one doesn't understand this truth and takes more than they need in an attempt to enjoy separately from Krishna, they lose the opportunity of this human form of life.
Okay, we have some little rhymes here that we can try to remember. So maybe we can all say this together. Spiritual knowledge is beyond our reach, therefore the Vedas are there to teach. Of the Lord's features, there are three, but as a person, he is most complete. Our quota is given to serve the Lord. Our future is black if we simply hoard. Probably can make songs out of that too. Okay, let's go on to 4 through 8. So 4 through 8 is still in the vision part. We're now at the knowledge of the Supreme Person. So mantra 4 is that the inconceivable Lord cannot be understood by our limited means. This is, by the way, not a very good projector, and so there's all kinds of things that the people on Zoom can see, but you guys can't. And mantra 5 is something about his inconceivable potencies. Anybody remember what's in mantra 5? Nope. Well, you can look that up later. And mantra 6 is actually, we have another new book, Krishna Meditations, and I was thinking about how mantra 6 really epitomizes. Why don't we read those two? The mood of that book. And 8 is how the Transcendental Lord is fulfilling all of our desires. So, okay, if we pull this up. So mantra 4 is, although fixed in his abode, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is swifter than the mind and can overcome all others running. The powerful demigods cannot approach him. Although in one place he controls those who supply the air and rain, he surpasses all in excellence. And then 5 is, the Supreme Lord walks and does not walk. He is far away, but very near. He is within everything, and yet he is outside. Okay. Now, mantra 6 is, again, those of you who got our Krishna Meditations book, it's really based on this mantra 6. He who systematically sees everything in relation to the Supreme Lord, who sees all living entities as his parts and parcels, and who sees the Supreme Lord within everything, never hates anything or any being. 7, one who always sees all living entities as spiritual sparks, in quality one with the Lord, becomes a true knower of things. What then can be illusion or anxiety for him? 8, such a person must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated, the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desires since time immemorial. Okay, so this is, now we knew already that the Supreme is complete, and that I connect with him. Now we're learning more about that Supreme, that he's full of paradoxes. He walks and doesn't walk. He's far away, he's near, he's within, he's without. And when I see him everywhere, when I see everything in relationship to him, then I'm liberated. Then I'm no longer affected by the things of this world. All right, now let's look at, again, Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So what is this Sambandha? He has unique characteristics. All contradictions, all paradoxes are resolved in him. And what's our practice that we can learn from those who are absorbed in him? And then what's our achievement? We become free of anxiety and we actually perceive him in this world and in everything. Okay, someone else would like to read this summary of 4 to 8?
The Supreme Lord is the greatest person and possesses unique characteristics. Within him, all contradictions are resolved. The pure devotees see everything and everyone in relation to him and are therefore completely free from anxiety on the transcendental platform. By rendering devotional service in this consciousness, they realize him directly.
And if we can say the rhyme together, inconceivable Lord may be far or near, but he is revealed to those who are dear. Again, I hope you like those. Those are little memory aids. You know, if you've got those, then those are like sutras. Okay, now we're going to go on to 9 through 11. Now, we're going to have an interesting situation in the Ishopanishad with 9 to 11 and 12 through 14. These are almost identical, except one is about knowledge and ignorance, and one is about knowing knowledge and ignorance, and the other is about worshiping the eternal and the temporary. So 9 through 11 is guidelines for knowledge, And then 12 through 14 is guidelines for practice. Okay, let's look at 9 through 11. So here we have the difference between nescience, or ignorance, ni science, what is not science, what is not knowing, and false knowledge. So basically, it's bad to be ignorant, and it's worse to think you know when you don't know. Right. It's bad to be ignorant, but even worse is to have so-called knowledge that's not real knowledge. Ignorance dressed as knowledge. Basically, you know, wolves are bad, but wolves that look like sheep are worse. And you get two different results, one from real knowledge and one from ignorance. And you have to know both. You have to know both. The Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavatam are full of knowledge of both. Their knowledge of the truth, the reality, and their knowledge of the shadow. Their knowledge of reality and illusion, Krishna and Maya. How much knowledge does Krishna give of the modes of material nature, for example? He's not just giving knowledge of the transcendent. We have to know both side by side. Okay. So this is, again, we're looking at Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So our Sambandha here is to know that ignorance and false knowledge both lead to darkness. We need to have real knowledge. What we have to do is we have to know, learn about what is ignorance and what is knowledge. And then what is our goal? To go beyond birth and death to immortality. Okay, somebody who would like to read this summary of mantras 9 through 11.
One falls down to being involved in innocence. People involved in ordinary mundane activities will go to the darkest region of ignorance, and the materialistic intellectuals will go to an even worse place. In order to become transcendental, you don't just forget about mundane things, but you learn to understand them from the transcendental platform. In this way, you get the proper picture and you become free from Maya.
This point is extremely important. We are not what sociologists call world-denying religion. You all know the story of Rishyasringa? You all know the story of Rishyasringa? So, he was fathered because his father had a difficult encounter with some higher being. And his father decided that he wanted to save his son from feminine allurements. And so he didn't allow his son to know that females existed. Not only female humans, but even female animals. So out in the forest, there is someone in the Guinness Book of World Records who never saw a female. It was someone whose mother died at birth, and he was raised by cloistered monks. And he never saw a woman in his entire life. So Rishyasringa not only didn't see women, he didn't see females. He didn't know that there was another gender. And when Dasarath had a drought in Ayodhya, he was told, you have to bring Rishyasringa to do a yajna. That's the only way you're going to get rain. And so he employed some unchaste ladies to go to the forest and bring Rishyasringa. And because Rishyasringa didn't know what women looked like, he was naturally attracted, because biology is still biology, but he didn't know why he was attracted, and he didn't even know who these beings were. And they fed him things like gulab jamuns and told him they were fruit, and he thought, oh, where do I get some more of these fruits? And he was brought to Ayodhya in that way. And he was the one who did a yajna that brought rain. He was also the one who did the yajna that produced the payasa for the four brothers, Ram, Lakshman, Bharat, and Shatrughna. But the point is, it didn't work. If you say, well, I'm not going to know anything about the material energy, it actually puts you in a position of weakness, not strength. You know, and there are devotees who think like this. Well, we're going to raise our children so they don't know anything about the world. But it actually makes them weak. It makes them not in a position. And that's not, actually, that's Falgu Vairagya. Because the world belongs to Krishna. In fact, the world is a manifestation of Krishna. And Prabhupada says if you go to a garden and you say everything's fake, everything's false, the gardener will be depressed. He says, don't depress Krishna like that. So the point is not to deny the world, but the point is how to understand the world properly. Okay, mantras 9 through 11, we can say this together. Without knowledge of material life, our material plans lead us to strife. So if all we know is ignorance, then we're going to be in trouble. We have to know both. Okay, mantras 12 through 14, this is practically a repeat of 9 through 11, except here we're talking about sambhutim as sambhutim. So here we're in the guidelines for practice. So in mantra 12, this is the sambhutim as sambhutim, which Prabhupada translates as demigods and the impersonal. So this is a very similar point as to ignorance is bad and false knowledge is worse. But this is materialism is bad and false spirituality is worse, is basically what it's about. And it's interesting here because generally we say that jnana is higher than karma. We're saying that worshipping the impersonal Brahman is higher than worshipping the demigods, that the impersonal Brahman is at least transcendental. So this is a very unusual verse in the Shastra, that it's saying better to worship the demigods than the Brahman. And there's at least one lecture where Prabhupada says, at least if you're worshiping the demigods, you're keeping your individuality. You're keeping your variety. But this is the same principle that a wolf is bad and a wolf dressed up like a sheep is worse. It's the same kind of principle. That it's bad to be a materialist, but it's even worse to be a false spiritualist. You'll cause more damage. And you get different results. So again, this, you know, different results from knowledge and ignorance. And here you get one result from worshipping the real Supreme and another result from worshipping anything that's not Supreme. And we should know both. We should know the Supreme and what's not Supreme. And Prabhupada really expands this translation because the mantra is just one should know sambhutim asambhutim. And Prabhupada expands it to one should know perfectly the personality of Godhead Sri Krishna and his transcendental name, form, qualities, and pastimes, as well as the temporary material creation with its temporary demigods, men, and animals. When one knows these, he surpasses death and the ephemeral cosmic manifestation with it, and in the eternal kingdom of God, he enjoys his eternal life of bliss and knowledge. So Prabhupada's taking sambhutim and asambhutim and really expanding it in his translation. So here we have again Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana. So what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to worship the real, we're supposed to have genuine spirituality. We're supposed to know what is materialism, what is false spirituality, and what is genuine spirituality. What are we supposed to do? We're supposed to study all of these. Because we have to be able to recognize the difference between them. And so I sometimes make the point that getting a wrong answer is a useful learning experience because it teaches you what something is not. Now, you may only want to get right answers on an exam, but when you're learning something, it's just as useful to know what something is not as what something is. Does that make sense? So one should learn all these things simultaneously. One has to be able to recognize what is materialism and what is false spiritualism, as well as what is real spiritualism. And what do we gain from this? We surpass death and we enjoy eternal bliss and knowledge. Okay, some other volunteer to read this summary?
For chanting in bhakti to be effective, we must distinguish between worship of the absolute and the relative, while honoring all the forms and names of the absolute. Then our chanting of Hare Krishna will quickly bring us to realization that our self and our sweet relationship with the one who is all attractive, Lord Sri Krishna.
Now we can say our rhyme together. You may worship the Supreme or you may not, but without eternal life, what have you got? Again, I hope you like that. Okay, now we're coming to the end of the Ishopanishad. So now we have prayers for knowledge, 15 through 16, and prayers for practice. So I'd actually like to read these. So our two prayers for knowledge. And if any of you have these handy, you can say it with me. If you don't, that's fine. Oh my Lord, sustainer of all that lives, your real face is covered by your dazzling effulgence. Kindly remove that covering and exhibit yourself to your pure devotee. Oh my Lord, O primeval philosopher, maintainer of the universe, O regulating principle, destination of the pure devotees, well-wisher of the progenitors of mankind, please remove the effulgence of your transcendental rays so that I can see your form of bliss. You are the eternal supreme personality of Godhead, like unto the sun as am I. Let this temporary body be burnt to ashes and let the air of life be merged with the totality of air. Now, O my Lord, please remember all my sacrifices, and because you are the ultimate beneficiary, please remember all that I have done for you. O my Lord, as powerful as fire, O omnipotent one, now I offer you all obeisances, falling on the ground at your feet. O my Lord, please lead me on the right path to reach you. And since you know all that I have done in the past, please free me from the reactions to my past sins, so that there will be no hindrance to my progress. So here you can see this is divided into, we want to see the Lord, two prayers to see the Lord beyond his effulgence, to know him, and then prayers for practice. We want the Lord to remember our service. We want him to guide us on the right path. So again, looking at Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. So to know the Lord's personal or Bhagavan feature beyond the Brahman. And to what should we do then? If we know that, we should pray to see that personal feature, to remember him at the time of death, to pray for eternal service. And what do we get? We get eternal service at his feet. Okay, somebody who'd like to read this?
The speaker feelingly appeals to the Lord to remove his dazzling bodily effulgence and reveal his personal form. The time of death is approaching, and the devotee acknowledges that he is far from perfect, but prays that the Lord be merciful to him, overlooking his shortcomings, accept him as his eternal servant, and give him shelter at his lotus feet.
Okay. Lord, we cannot see beyond your glow, but it is you we wish to know. Lord, for this spiritual life, on you I depend, to always be there as a guide and a friend. And here we have a whole summary of the whole Ishopanishad. Okay, would somebody be willing to read this?
First, we learn that both spiritual and material happiness come from acting as a part of the complete whole, overflowing with love, completely full. We then learn the qualities of the Lord and the vision and the consciousness needed to understand those inconceivable attributes. Then we distinguish between the supreme and everything else. Ignorance, false knowledge, materialistic religion, and lesser forms of transcendence. Now that we know what we want, love of Krishna, and why we want it for complete satisfaction of everything, we engage in bhakti.
You all happy?
Yeah.
Okay. We could take any questions on Ishopanishad before we go to the Upadeshamrita.
Hare Krishna.
Yes.
Is there a reason why Ishopanishad doesn't directly glorify the personal picture of the Lord?
You mean why it doesn't have specific information
on the personal
feature of the Lord? I guess not everything does everything. Mm-hmm. I one time went to a Sunday feast class where in 45 minutes the speaker tried to describe everything. It was the worst class I've ever attended. And I often wish that I'd recorded it so that I could use it when I teach how to speak as an example of what not to do. You know, and when you're giving something in a summary, you're looking just at some things. You're not looking at everything. So if you take, you know, a particular chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, it's describing some things and not others, or a chapter of the Bhagavatam, or a chapter of Chaitanya Charitamrita, or whatever, you know. There's a particular, each thing has its particular purpose, its particular objective, its particular goal.
Possible that they're associating with people who have understood the complete, that one can also become complete?
We are complete when we're connected. I mean, the analogy Prabhupada gives all the time is, you know, a disconnect. If your finger's cut off, it's useless. When it's connected, it's my finger is complete because it's part of my complete body. Or he talks about a little screw, you know, a little screw that comes out of a machine. Prabhupada says you'll sweep it up with the garbage. But when it's in the machine, it's very valuable. It becomes complete. It becomes part of the complete whole. And when it's separated, it's incomplete. We conditioned souls. Do any of you have like a junk drawer? Right? Like a drawer of all miscellaneous stuff? And if you find some little screw or some little piece of plastic sitting, and you think, I know this is part of something. And maybe it's part of something important. And maybe someday I'll find out what it's part of. Let me put it in this drawer. So the whole material world is kind of like that. It's like a big junk drawer, you know? All these little disconnected pieces. Nobody knows where they go. And once we're in our right place, then again we're complete. I mean, it's actually incredible. Once we're connected with Krishna, we can experience everything that Krishna experiences. We can experience everything through him. When we're separated, all we can experience is what we can experience, and it's so limited. And especially through the material senses, it's ridiculously limited. I can't even see beyond the wall. Anything else on Ishopanishad? Yes?
I was just wondering if you could just explain, in one of the earlier verses, the Lord is described as the self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desires since time immemorial. Very rarely do I hear the Lord described in that way, the self-sufficient philosopher. I was just wondering if you could explain why that is.
A self-sufficient philosopher. I was just thinking about Lord Kapiladeva as the greatest philosopher. Or Narayan Rishi is the greatest philosopher. Isn't Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra the greatest philosopher? Yeah. I think so. Or speaking to Uddhava, he's the greatest philosopher. And self-sufficient, he doesn't need, I mean, of course he goes to school, but he doesn't need to go to school. So he doesn't need to go to school. He doesn't need a teacher. He understands everything himself. Such a nice name for Krishna, huh? Self-sufficient philosopher. He didn't need a degree. He doesn't need to put a degree up in his wall from a university. Is that right? Anybody else? Anything on Ishopanishad?
One more.
Why are you sorry? I asked your questions. Does anyone have any questions? I'm sorry, I have a question. No, that's fine.
To take others,
but no one else raised their hand, so it's fine.
I'll go for that.
All right.
Is there a specific reason why Shri Prabhupada added the invocation mantra to set the tone for Ishopanishad, right? That's the context setting for the whole Ishopanishad.
Well, it's part of the Ishopanishad.
Okay.
It's not something he added. I'm not understanding you correctly.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong. My question is wrong. My understanding was the first loka invocation was not technically part of Ishopanishad.
Oh, yes. No, it is. It is. Actually, there's... I have several times visited a school in London called St. James. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. And it's a very interesting school. So their philosophy, I don't know who their teacher is, like who their acharya is. It's some combination of Sankaracharya and Christianity. It's an interesting something. Like they're all vegetarians there, and they teach Sanskrit. In fact, I'd say they have one of the best Sanskrit programs anywhere in the world. There's a husband and wife who are Sanskrit teachers there. They developed all their own curriculum. I mean, we're just starting to have devotee schools that approach their level of academic expertise and curriculum development. They've written all their own curriculum. And their students are wide demographic of British kids. I mean, they have Indian students, but only in relation to how many Indians are in the UK population. It's So you have all these, and they're not like Hare Krishna devotee kids. So you have all these, you know, white-skinned, blue-eyed, blonde-haired kids chanting the Rig Veda. And you can look on YouTube. It's, you know, you go there and you think you're on another planet. Like it's something. And they're all chanting the invocation to the Ishopanishad. It's one of the things. They call that the perfect mantra. So the, like the, some of the classes will start to say, let us chant the perfect mantra. And Om Purnamada Purnamada Vyasat. Or I was teaching career dharma right before the pandemic. I mean, right before the pandemic. Like I was teaching it in March 2020, the day I finished the world lockdown. literally. If I had not gotten off of that island on that day, I would have been stuck in the Bahamas. Which, that might sound very nice, but they don't grow any food there, so it would not have been a nice place to have been stuck. But that was, you know, they're impersonalists. But they invite devotees there. They invite our, you know, ISKCON members there to give seminars and to lead kirtans and things like that. But they were all chanting. So the Ishopanishad invocation, it's actually quite a popular mantra. When I spent some years studying Sanskrit, although I never got very far. But I was learning, when I was studying from this American group that's mostly impersonalist, but that was one of their prime mantras for teaching was Om Purnamada Purnamada. So it's very well known. Yes?
Mataji, why do we study Ishopanishad only, not any other Upanishad?
I don't know the answer to that question. I think that would have been a question to have asked Srila Prabhupada, and I don't know if anyone ever asked him that question. That's a very good question, but if I find out the answer, I will let you know. I mean, I do know that Srila Bhakti Sanatana Sarasvati Thakur taught the Ishopanishad. Does anyone know where he taught the Ishopanishad? Yes, you said Radhakunda? Yes, and he was criticized for that. The local Babaji's criticized him. They said, why are you here at Radhakund teaching the Ishopanishad? And you should be teaching Govinda Lilamrita at Radhakund, not Ishopanishad. Yeah. So that may be one reason why Srila Prabhupada translated the Ishopanishad. I mean, one can speculate that if Prabhupada started his mission earlier in life or lived longer, that he would have translated more. That's a very difficult thing to say. What would Srila Prabhupada have translated next and what further things would he have translated? Like, I tend to believe that not only would he have finished the Bhagavatam, which he said he wanted to do, but he would have done a full translation of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu instead of just a summary study, things like that. Would he have gone to other Upanishads? I don't.
What was Bhaktisiddhanta's response to them when they said that?
You know, I don't know the answer to that either. It's another question I don't know the answer to. I could ask Pranava Prabhu, who's a... And if you know Pranava, he runs the Bhaktivedanta Research Center in Calcutta. And his doctoral thesis was on Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. So, if you send me that question on WhatsApp, then I can ask Pranava Prabhu. All right? So... Alright, now I've got to remember in what order did I do this. One has to do this in a very particular order for it to work. Ta-da! All right. Everybody ready for Nectar of Instruction?
Yes.
Okay, and how many papers do you have on that? I think you have quite a few, right?
Three.
Five.
All right, I think I have a copy of it here. This way I can... Okay, so on this one page, page 5, you have a summary on one page of the whole book. And then the others are going bit by bit. And again, not everything in the PowerPoint is going to match what's on the paper and so forth. There is, on my website, urmiladevidasi.org, on free educational materials, there is a hefty study guide for the Upadeshamrita compiled by Srimati Devidasi in Vrindavan that's downloadable there, if you really want to go more deeply. Okay, so the nectar of instruction, or the Upadeshamrita, is taking us from Shraddha to Prema in 11 verses. By the way, Srila Prabhupada translated this book after being requested to do so by one of his disciples, Rishikesh Prabhu. Rishikesh had been studying in Vrindavan, and he specifically said to Srila Prabhupada, would you translate the Upadeshamrita? And Prabhupada said, yes, that's a good idea, and he decided to do that. So one can understand this text in this way, that texts 1 through 3 are about Shraddha, 4 through 6 about Sadhu Sangha, 7 through 8, text 7, Vajna Kriya, Anartha Nivritti, Nishta and Ruchi, then 8, Ashakti, and 9 through 11, Bhava and Prema. It's possible to understand it that way. Okay, if you also look at the papers, the way you can understand it is texts 1, 2, and 3 are about ourselves and our life, and on the next page, 4, 5, and 6 are about devotees and society. 7 and 8 are about being absorbed in Krishna. And 9, 10, 11 are about what's better and best. So one can also understand it that way. That first we have to know about ourselves and our own life. Then we can associate with devotees. Through association with devotees, we can perform the process of bhakti. By performing the process of bhakti, we can attain to the best destination. So we can also divide it into 4 sections like that. Okay, so this is organized a little bit differently. So here we have our rhyme first for verses 1 through 3. Everyone together? Senses and mind in Lord's service we use, hindrance avoid while good help we do choose. So the big picture of 1 to 2 and 3 is 1 to 2 is the don'ts and 3 is the do's. And again, we can think of 1 through 3 as ourselves and our lives. So here Srila Rupa Goswami is teaching about having sense control, that's the top picture, and mind control, which is the second picture. And I hope you can read this sort of kind of... Yeah. All right, and what kind of control? To control our speaking. And here we can refer to the 5 austerities of speech that Krishna talks about. Truthful, that the message is pleasing, that it's beneficial, that the words are not agitating, like you don't use curse words, not coarse language, and that you recite Vedic literature. Does anyone know of those 5? What's the most important? Beneficial, yes. Excellent. A lot of people think it's being truthful. But no. If you speak truth that's harmful, can you speak truth that's harmful? Is that possible? Sure it is. Have you ever seen an ugly baby? I've seen ugly babies. I saw one little baby looked like a pig. Like the nose was like this. And if I go to the mother and say, your baby looks like a pig. It's true. But it's not beneficial. Right? Beneficial is more important. And even sometimes truth can be sacrificed for beneficial. The husband should say to his wife, you're the most beautiful woman in the world. Even though objectively, she looks in the mirror and she goes, hmm? And she's looking in the mirror and she's saying, I don't think so. But maybe he believes that. Well, that's nice. So that's necessary. Yes? The highest thing was beneficial. And a pleasing message in words that are not agitating to others are the least important. I mean, Krishna tried to be very kind and say, learned people don't talk like this. You're speaking very wisely, Arjuna, but actually wise people don't talk like this. So he was trying to use very kind language. But sometimes the sadhus use heavy language. You're a fool. Prabhupada would say, these people are mudhas. And then he'd say, I'm not saying, Krishna's saying. They're rascals. Well, sometimes you need to shake somebody a little bit. And it's not always pleasing to tell people, you know, you're an illusion. You're proud, you're arrogant. That's not always pleasing. You can't give people truth if you're just going to give them a message that's pleasing. It's not going to help people. Everybody's okay. Whatever you want to do is all right. You know, that's not really going to be helpful. The doctor can't just say, whatever you want to eat, it's all right. You know, so sometimes you have to give a harsh message. Hey, you have to exercise more. You have to quit smoking. You have to cut out the fat, whatever it is. Right? The main thing is beneficial. And the mind on Krishna, on Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes, this can also mean that we see Krishna in the world. He's the sound in ether, including the children yelling outside. He's our ability. He's the light. He's the taste in water. That's also his form and his qualities. And then to be angry at the demons, be careful, because a lot of times when we think we're being angry properly, we're just being angry out of ego. I want to be extremely careful in using anger. Krishna says anger is one of the three demoniac qualities that every sane person should give up. So this, we have to be extremely, extremely careful with that. Take care of the tongue and belly with prasadam. Of course, not eating, just to satisfy the tongue in the name of prasadam. To use the genitals to produce good children in marriage. It's one of the main purposes of the Grahastha Ashram, is to produce good children. Oh goodness, I have 9 things in the chat. Should I look at them? I wasn't paying the slightest attention. Oh, this was all just stuff in the beginning. I'm so used to not using Zoom now. Actually, as I've traveled, sometimes people have said to me, can you give our morning Bhagavatam class to our local people on Zoom? And I'm like, no. I was doing that for years. What did I get on a plane for? I just stayed in America and done Zoom. All right, and then what hinders us? What stops us? Too much or the wrong kind? Too much money, more money than we need. too much knowledge, too many rules. Years ago, I was in Croatia, and this one gentleman was there, and he said, when I first came to the Hare Krishna movement, they said, there's no hard and fast rules. And the more I come, the more rules there are. He said, your rule book keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Too many achievements. And the wrong kind of things, the wrong kind of talking, the wrong kind of friends. So how do we solve these hindrances? Prabhupada talks in the purport about simple living, being under the shelter of the internal energy, and living in devotee society. And we could, of course, talk about that for a long time. Then what's helpful? Enthusiastic, confident patience. If you're just enthusiastic, you may be in Rajagun. If you're just confident, you may be in Sattvagun. And if you're just patient, you may be in Tamagun. I'm patient. But I'm not going to do anything. I'm enthusiastic. I want my prema right now. So all of these together, then we're actually balanced. We're enthusiastic, confident, and patient. It's hard to be that, isn't it? That's not easy. Easy to say. Very hard to do. I'm confident that I will attain Krishna prema through this process. I'm enthusiastic and patient. It's extremely difficult. Enthusiasm, we're thinking, I'm enthusiastic and I want to get the results right now. And it's not working right now. I'm giving up. I've been taking this medicine for 2 days and I'm still sick, you know. But not so patient that you don't have enthusiasm. Well, it's a gradual process. Then to follow the principles with the devotees in the way that the devotees have done them. Wow, is that important? To follow the principles of bhakti with devotees as the devotees have set an example of how to do them. Not making stuff up. Not neglecting things and not making stuff up. Not adding things, not subtracting things, not changing things from the basic stuff. We have to adapt to time, place, and circumstance. We're actually required to do that. Prabhupada says that is required. But the basic stuff, we leave it alone. Don't change mantras and add mantras. I keep hearing people adding mantras. I'm going to say something that's really going to bother all of you. What is this weird mantra you guys are chanting about Lord Jagannath? It's really weird, and I'm not going to say anything more about that. But it's really weird. And so I'm hearing this, and I'm going, where is that from? So I'm going to say that and shut up. Okay, on practical action, Prabhupada translates as endeavor executed with intelligence in Krishna consciousness. What an interesting quote. Endeavor executed with intelligence in Krishna consciousness. So we're working hard with intelligence and being aware of Krishna. I'm aware of Krishna, I'm using my brain, and I'm doing something practical. All three things. I'm doing some endeavor, I'm using my intelligence, and I'm aware of Krishna. And then the nine processes of bhakti, which Prabhupada explains so nicely in this purport, and using everything in Krishna's service. So this is a really nice explanation of the nine processes of bhakti. And Prabhupada talks about atonement, that don't repent just to sin again, that's useless. That's like the elephants bathing. And of course, when Prabhupada talked about that, he was in a society where he saw a lot of elephants. I was thinking for most of us, it's like elephants bathing. I don't see elephants bathing. The analogy doesn't so much work for us. But, you know, elephants go into a body of water and then they throw dirt on themselves. They do that to get rid of insects, actually. But it seems rather silly to take a bath and then throw dirt on yourself again. So therefore, it's this comparison to elephants bathing. And then controlling the urges of the tongue by eating only prasadam. Not to do unnecessary talking. I find that one hard, never to talk any prajalpa. Sometimes Prabhupada includes prajalpa with gambling. And I'm like, oh my God. You know. Never to do any kind of gossip or unnecessary talking. It's hard, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, do you know what happened to so-and-so? I don't know. Did they do this? Did they do that? Then it's like, who's just prajalpa? And then getting this bhakti lata bija. And how do we get this? Of course, this is a big topic that we could talk about for a week or so. How do we get this seed of bhakti? So I was just reading today in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Prabhupada was talking about how bhakti is inherent and the guru is simply uncovering it. So Gopinath Acharya Prabhu wrote a wonderful article in ISKCON Communications Journal number 13 about how if you have a mango seed, the mango tree is inherent in the seed, but still someone has to plant it and water it. The seed is useless. It will never produce a mango tree if it's not put in the soil and it's not watered. So without the guru, without the devotees, no mango tree will ever manifest, but the mango tree is inherent in the seed. The guru and the sadhus, they're not creating bhakti in us. Sri Rupa Goswami says bhakti is not derived from any other source. It's already within us. At the same time, it can't manifest without the grace of the devotees. Right? I know that archaeologists have dug up in Egypt, they've dug up like chickpeas, you know, garbanzo beans that are thousands of years old. And when they soak them, some of them sprout. So just sitting there, they will never sprout. So without the touch of the devotees, nothing will actually grow. All right. So we've done 1 through 3, which is about taking care of ourselves. Now we're going to go to 4 through 6, which is how we relate to others. Okay, we can say this. Loving exchange with the Vaishnavs are 6. No Vaishnavs 3, and how with them we mix, based on their faith, but not their body's hues. All right. So we have here again the do's and do nots. In number 4, it's how do we do sadhu sangha. And then 5 and 6 is kind of like a little bit more detail of what we kind of don't do. How do we do it as a form of bhajan? So 4, of course, I'm sure you all know 4. Dati, Pranigridnati, the 6 loving exchanges. And basically, you're about 3. Giving gifts, giving confidences, giving food, getting gifts, getting confidences, and getting food. So I often teach this as a whole class. You know, what are these 6 loving exchanges? So basically, it's trying to give people what they actually want and what, very much like speech, what will benefit them. You give people the prasadam that they want to eat. Even Krishna does that, you know. It says that Krishna, when he's out in the forest, he gives each cowherd boy what they want to eat. Or Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when there's a big festival, he goes, of course, he gives everybody too much. And so Swarupa Damodar tells him to sit down. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is putting on everybody's plate, especially what they like. So we should give people prasadam, the kind of prasadam they like, the quantity of prasadam they like. We're not just serving a plate, we're serving a person. And when I'm taking prasadam, I should remember that I'm not just being served by a spoon, I'm being served by a person. To be respectful of the person who's serving, respectful of the person who's cooking. Okay. So that it's actually an exchange of love. And to be appreciative. I mean, sometimes it's hard, right? Sometimes you're given something that isn't to your liking or it isn't cooked right or something, and sometimes it's difficult. Yes? But you always try to remember that this is a loving exchange. And with gifts also, to give people gifts that they actually want and they can use. And again, this is hard. I don't always know what someone's going to appreciate. I don't always know what someone's going to use. But to try. To make some effort to figure that out. What might somebody like? What might somebody use? What might be pleasing? And then when we get gifts, to try to be appreciative, even if it's not what we like or it's not what we can use. And again, that's also difficult. When I was 6, at my birthday, I got 6 pairs from 6 different people of red leggings. They must have been on sale or something. You know? And when I opened up the 6 box, I started to cry. You know, I was 6 years old, and my mother quickly took me to my room and said, just say thank you. She said, we'll exchange them later, but right now, just say thank you. You know, so that, but sometimes it's hard. Sometimes you're looking at it and thinking, what is this? What am I going to do with this? How am I going to re-gift it without anybody knowing? But to try as hard as we can to be personal and gracious. And then confidences. When we reveal our mind, to try to reveal our mind in a way that will benefit the person who's hearing us. This is also difficult. Sometimes people think revealing their mind means doing a garbage dump. Sometimes we have to talk about our problems and our struggles, but to try to do so in a way that will also benefit the person who's hearing. We shouldn't be using the person like a garbage can. That's also taking something that's not our quota, isn't it? It's actually stealing something from the other person. Because we'll put the person in an awkward situation where they're not going to say, excuse me, you're using me like a garbage can. I think I'm going to go now. You know, that's a little difficult. And so the person often gets stuck in that situation. So to make sure that when we reveal our mind in confidence, that it's done in a way that will enliven ourselves and the other person as much as possible. That's hard. I know it's hard. But it's worth it. Then we end up with Majjitam Agatha Pranam Bodhiyantas Prasvam Katayantashtamam Nityam Tushanti Charamanticha. And when I hear other people's confidences, to try to do so in a way that's going to uplift me and the other person. Again, to focus on this beneficial, to do something that's going to be full of satisfaction and pleasure. Now, we have here about, in verse 5, associating with devotees according to their status. Now, these words, Kanista, Majjhima, and Uttama, a rough translation in English would just be beginner, intermediate, and advanced. Now, what I'm about to say is very important, but I don't have long to explain it, so I hope I'm going to make this clear. One can be beginning, intermediate, and advanced in different areas. Like what we didn't discuss in the Ishopanishad was there is one, I can't remember which purport, there's one purport where Prabhupada's also talking about Kanista, Majjhima, and Uttama. And there he's referencing the definitions in the 11th canto. That the Kanista only sees God in the temple, or only in his temple. The Majjhima tries to love God, make friends with the devotees, help the innocent and avoid the atheists. And the Uttama sees God everywhere. But this Kanista, Majjhima, and Uttama is looking at something different. And Srila Rupa Goswami in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, when he talks about Kanista Adhikari, Majjhima Adhikari, Uttama Adhikari, is talking about something completely different. He's talking there about qualifications to take up Vaidhi Bhakti. So you can be a beginner, intermediate, and advanced in different areas of bhakti. And a beginner in one definition is not a beginner in another definition. Let's look at a material example. So if you take someone who's, say, 14, 15 years old, and you're going to talk about how mature they are, well, you could talk about physically, intellectually, emotionally, socially, right? And those don't all coincide. Some people are very mature intellectually and immature physically, or mature physically and immature socially. Correct? This happens all the time. Now, hopefully, eventually, they're mature in everything. But if you look at a particular time, they may be only mature in some things. Just like I would guess that each of us finds something in the process of bhakti very easy to do. We don't even have to think about it. Like, for myself, I don't think I ever gambled in my life. Maybe when I was a child I bought a raffle ticket, but I don't even remember. So for me, not gambling is so easy. I've never gambled. So giving up gambling was not, I wasn't giving up anything. So who of you has something in bhakti that's just extremely easy? How many of you have something in bhakti that's extremely easy? Should be all of you. Isn't there something that's just so, you don't even have to think about it. It's just there. Right? I'm sure for most of us, being a vegetarian is very easy, isn't it?
Yes.
Do you have to think about it? Do you have to struggle with it? Okay, I'm going to ask again. Who has something in bhakti that's just extremely easy? Okay. Then there may be something that we do, and we do it regularly, but we have to make some effort. It's in the I have to make some effort category. We do it, but it's some effort. It's somewhere in the middle. So who has something like that? And who has something that they've been trying and trying and still not very good at it? Okay, now what's really interesting, and we're not going to do this, don't worry, but what's really interesting is if we all wrote down what those were, they'd be different for each of us. Like, I know some devotees who really struggle with gambling. Before they joined the movement, they were gambling addicts, and it's something that's really hard for them. Whereas for me, it's absolutely nothing. So my absolute nothing easy may be your struggle. Right? And my struggle may be your easy. Does that make sense? Yes? So we're all very advanced in some ways. Everyone here is very advanced in some things. And we're beginners in other things, and we're intermediates in other things. But we're not all at a beginning platform, or all at an intermediate. It's not like that. So when we're looking at beginning, intermediate, and advanced in these different definitions, we're looking at different things. Or Prabhu who drove me, Devahuti Kapila, he was talking to me about Manashiksha. And there, in the very first verse, commentary by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he talks about beginning, intermediate, advanced devotees in a very different way than these other definitions. He talks about the beginning devotees are brahmanas who teach about varnashram, intermediate are serious spiritual practitioners of any faith, and advanced are people who want to go to Krishna in Vrindavan. It's a completely different definition of beginning, intermediate, and advanced. So just be careful, because if we say someone's a Madhyama devotee, By what measurement? Is it the 11th canto one? Is it the Manashiksha one? Is it the Nectar Devotion one? Is it this one? Is it the Upadeshamrita one? They're not the same. Okay, so here the beginner is somebody who chants Hare Krishna, which includes people who have Harinam initiation. But someone can chant just once, and Prabhupada in the purport talks about a famous person. Does anyone know what famous person he talks about? Prabhupada talks about George Harrison in this purport, in the Kanista category here. He likes to chant Hare Krishna. We respect them within the mind. We respect them at least within the mind. Then the next category is those who've received Diksha. Diksha is what we call second initiation. Gayatri initiation, and they're working as a second initiated person. They're serving the deity particularly. And those people, we offer obeisances to them. So sometimes people offer obeisances to me, and when I offer obeisances back to them, they say, no, no, no. And I said, but Srila Rupa Goswami says that I have to do that. Now, what we're looking at here is levels of commitment. Chanting casually or taking first initiation, Harinam initiation, is not as much of a level of commitment as taking Diksha and actually engaged in worshipping the deity. And here we're looking at Uttama, unalloyed, with cessation, undeviated devotional service. At every moment they're doing Krishna consciousness. There's not a moment break. And fascinating that of all the Vaishnava qualities, Srila Rupa Goswami says they have no tendency to criticize others. Not even that they don't do it. I mean, there are times that I don't criticize, but I want to. I just don't. It's so sad among human beings that no one else ever gives us credit for what we don't do, right? Because they have no idea that we're not doing it. It's like, you didn't know that I wanted to criticize you and I didn't. Yes. But those who are Uttama Bhaktas, they don't have any desire to criticize, because they don't have any envy. So this is levels of commitment. And for the Uttama, that one serves that person. So one responds differently according to one's level of commitment, beginning, intermediate, and advanced. Now, all these we don't really have time to get into it at all, but these are not self-righteous judgments. These are just practical things to know how to relate to others. It's not that I go around and say, well, you're bad in this person. That's not what that's for. Okay, how not to determine who we associate with. We don't determine according to the body. If somebody's handicapped, they're ugly, you know, they have some sort of deformity, or something external, who their parents are, what country they're from, their gender, maybe, their age, that we don't look at Vaishnavas in that way. That's not the criteria. And if we do, then we're committing the mad elephant offense. So every form of yoga, karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, bhakti yoga, there is some sort of danger, which is nicely explained by Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami in the analogy of Sarvagya, the astrologer. And the danger of bhakti is thinking, I'm more devoted than you. Or you're not really devoted because of this superficial thing. Looking at something that's very external and saying, well, you know, you're not really a good devotee because, whatever, your nose is too big, or, you know, you only have one leg, or you're ugly, or you're poor, or something like that. So that becomes a mad elephant defense that destroys our spiritual progress. Okay, so some important terms is dadati, offering gifts in charity. And Prabhupada says we should use at least 50% in Krishna's service. That doesn't mean you have to give, I hope I'm not going to get in trouble here, that doesn't mean you have to give 50% of your gross income to the temple. Now they're never going to invite me back again. But it does mean that we should use at least half of our energy and half of our prosperity in devotional service. A Goswami is one who can control his senses. It's not a hereditary title. And then unalloyed devotion, which means that we're not mixing it with the other forms of yoga. Okay, we're going to go on to text 7-8. Name may seem bitter, but taste is so sweet. Chant and remember the whole day complete. So 7 is about Bhajana Kriya and Artha Nivritti, Nishtha and Ruchi, and 8 is about Ashakti. So once we have these other things down, once we have our own life together, what I do and do not, and once I figured out how to associate with devotees, now I can really engage in the process of bhakti. So in 7 introduces us to Krishna Nam Guna Rupa Lila. And let's... Let's read 7 and 8. 7 is, if you have, you can read along with me. The holy name, character, pastimes, and activities of Krishna are all transcendentally sweet like sugar candy, although the tongue of one afflicted by the jaundice of avidya, ignorance, cannot taste anything sweet. It is wonderful that simply by carefully chanting these sweet names every day, a natural relish awakens within his tongue, and his disease is gradually destroyed at the root. The essence of all advice is that one should utilize one's full time, 24 hours a day, in nicely chanting and remembering the Lord's divine name, transcendental form, qualities, and eternal pastimes, thereby gradually engaging one's tongue and mind. In this way, one should reside in Vraja, Goloka Vrindavan Dhamma, and serve Krishna under the guidance of devotees. One should follow in the footsteps of the Lord's beloved devotees who are deeply attached to his devotional service. And so what Srila Rupa Goswami is saying is if you do this, you will be living in the spiritual world. You'll not actually be experiencing that you're in the material world. And Prabhupada talks about the stages of chanting. Offensive chanting to the clearing stage to pure chanting. I was having a discussion, or I'm in the midst of having a discussion with one very senior ISKCON leader about our initiation vows. And I was saying how when we vow to chant 16 rounds, we're not vowing to chant offenselessly. Although Prabhupada talks about the 10 offenses. But we're supposed to become offenseless. it's understood that when we're starting, we may be committing, we are probably committing so many offenses. But we should be trying to clear that. And clearing that brings us to getting rid of our anarthas. And so here, of course, in the purport, Prabhupada talks about these stages of bhakti, which to some extent, we said, are exemplified in the Upadeshamrita itself. So the verses of the Upadeshamrita can be correlated with these, and we don't have time to discuss these in depth at all. Simply to say that throughout Srila Prabhupada's books, you'll find direct and indirect references to this list all over the place. Once you become aware of it, once you become kind of sensitized to it, Prabhupada doesn't always use exactly the same terms, doesn't always explain it in exactly the same way. Sometimes he just explains part of the list. Sometimes he skips one or two of them. But he's referring to it over and over and over and over and over. If you really want to go deeply into understanding these, there's a wonderful book. And if you know what it is? There's a book that specifically talks of that. The whole book is just about this. Well, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, yes. But there's a much shorter book. It's about this thing. Madhurya Kadambini by Vishila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. What a nice book. What a nice book. And it's very, very short. It's like this short. It's a very short book. And it's just, he calls them showers of nectar, and they really are showers of nectar. And he explains each of these in depth. So I cannot recommend that book enough. You know, I don't know how many times I've read it, but many, 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 many times. And of course, the most wonderful is the eighth shower of nectar, where the devotee with prema actually comes to interact with the Lord. Just absolutely wonderful. So just quickly. One has some beginning faith. Their God exists. So most of the people of the world, if you say, do you believe in God? Yes, I believe in God. What do you do about it? Nothing. So the next step is you actually do something about it. You associate with spiritually minded people. That's a big step, because some of your materialistic friends will not want to hang out with you anymore if you do that. So that's a big step, and a lot of people start that and then pull back. Because as soon as they start hanging out with sadhus, some of their non-sadhu friends will say, hey, what's wrong with you? So that's it. That is a huge step, just hanging out with sadhu people. Then Bhajana Kriya, you actually start practicing some system of devotion. So a small minority of religious people in every religion actually do some sort of regular religious or spiritual practice. Like, it's only a minority of Muslims who actually do 5 times a day prayer. There's a minority of Catholics who go to morning mass every day. And so of all the people who say, you know, I believe in God, only a small portion of them actually hang out with other believers, other people of faith. And only a small portion of them have some regular, serious spiritual practice. Right? Like, we have some huge congregation that comes for Janmashtami, but how many of them do any kind of daily serious practice? Right? Now, those who do a daily serious practice, only a small portion of them really want to change their heart. And by the way, it's the people who are in Bhajana Kriya who don't come to Anartha Nivritti that give religion a bad name all over the world. Because they look like they're strict, but they haven't actually cleansed their heart. So Anartha Nivritti Prabhupada will sometimes just talk about, you know, no illicit sex, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, which are big deals in the age of Kali. But Anartha Nivritti has to go deeper than that. It has to be giving up, you know, pride and lust and anger and greed and false ego and all this kind of stuff, madness and illusion. Right? It's on a deep level, like we were talking about with Ishopanishad, encroaching on others' property. It's coming at a deep level, on the most subtle level, to just accepting my quota, to being completely satisfied and happy with who and what I am as a spirit soul, and not trying to take something that's not mine. To be happy and satisfied with my relationship with Krishna. So that's the ultimate Anartha Nivritti, that I'm satisfied, right? as Advaitacharya says, Chaitanya Dasamuri, Chaitanya Radasa, Chaitanya Radasamuri, Tanra Dasa Radasa. I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, I am a servant of Lord Chaitanya, I am a servant of his servants. To just be satisfied with that, that is ultimately anartha nivritti, and very few people want to do that. Very few people. It both amuses me and saddens me how many people will come and ask me questions that they don't really want to know the answer to. But I said to one of my friends, this seems like it's a doorway made. I said, it looks like humility is a doorway made out of fire. And she laughed. She says, no, it's just a door. But we look at it and we think, oh, humility, I'm going to burn to death. If I actually become humble, if I actually become a servant, my whole life will fall apart. Right? I had someone at the temple right the other day say, well, I have to keep my anger. Right? You remember that? Yeah. So very, very few go through anartha nivritti. Now, once you go through anartha nivritti, everything becomes very easy. Prabhupada says, until nishtha, it's a hard struggle with determination, and after that, everything comes easily one after another. So when I was a little kid, you know, there was always snow. I don't know, probably none of you have ever even seen snow. But, you know, if you want to go sledding, you first have to bring your sled up the hill, and then you can go sliding down. Or maybe you've done that with a bicycle, right? You walk your bicycle up a hill, and then you can ride down very quickly. So once one gets through anartha nivritti, actually Prabhupada says 50%. According to Madhuri Kadambani, it looks like 40%. Once you're about halfway through anartha nivritti, then you start realizing your swarup. You've cleaned enough of the mirror, Chaita, Dharpa, and Marjana. Then you become fixed. You become fixed not philosophically, but by practical experience, pratyaksha avagamam dharma. Then you get a real taste for service. Then you get a real taste for Krishna, Ashakti, and then one enters into perfection. Up through Ashakti is practice. But this is it's definitely a funnel. That fewer and fewer people want to take that. The next step seems scary to them, especially up to anartha nivritti. So this is spending one's whole time chanting Hare Krishna, 24 hours a day, to always chant Hare Krishna. Now in the 8th verse, Srila Prabhupada talks about the stages of meditation. These stages of meditation are also described in the 11th verse commentary of Srila Bhakti, in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary to the 11th verse of Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha. It's also described by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his book Jiva Dharma, in his book Harinam Chintamani, and it's also described by Srila Jiva Goswami in one of the Sandarbhas, and I can't remember which one at this particular moment. And Srila Prabhupada here in this purport is quoting from Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati. Right, so I'm just going to go through these super fast. Again, I give a whole seminar on this. And I'm going to give the analogy of making real burfi. How many of you have ever made real burfi? Not powdered milk burfi, but real burfi. Any of you ever made real burfi? How many of you have ever seen real burfi being made? All right, well, that's a little better, so maybe this will work. First meditation is hearing, but meditative hearing. Not hearing so you can pass your Bhakti Shastri exam, not that, but actual meditative hearing. I'm good. Hearing where we're trying to enter into the mood of what we're hearing. Srila Rupa Goswami describes this in the Northern Ocean of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, where we actually try to experience the emotions of the devotees we're hearing about, the great devotees. He says, just like if you watch any drama, you experience the emotions of the characters in the drama. So meditative hearing. So that's like if you were cooking burfi, this is like you've poured your milk into the pot. Okay, accepting. What you've heard about actually becomes part of you. This is like you've turned the fire on under the pot. All right, then we come to remembering, which has 5 subcategories. Okay, now this is like you're actually stirring that milk in the pot. So the first is interrupted. So, you know, you're boiling that milk, you stir the milk, and then you're cutting some carrots, and then you stir the milk, and you wash the beans, and you stir the milk, and you make the chapati dough, and you stir the milk, and you answer your phone, and you stir the milk. So your meditation is like that. You remember Krishna, and then it's interrupted. You're remembering, and then you're interrupted. Then uninterrupted. You're just stirring that milk all the time. But this is surface uninterrupted. Okay? Like, so some of you are listening to me interrupted. You're listening to me and then you're thinking of something else, and you're listening to me and then you're thinking of something else. You're listening to me. Some of you are just listening, but it's surface. All right, now the next is concentrated. We're remembering in a deep way. It's really going into us. It's like saturating us. That's like your milk is getting thick. Now then, expanded meditation goes out of our meditation times, which is our japa, our Gayatri, our reading, and it starts going into our life. So this is, you see, when you cook the burfi, then it starts, as it's cooking down and gets concentrated, it also kind of starts expanding in the pan. And then samadhi. Now this is samadhi on the platform of the mind. And this is explained very nicely in the third canto, that there's a samadhi on the mind and there's a samadhi that's transcendental. Samadhi is an effortless flow. So your mind is effortlessly flowing in remembrance. But that's all the platform of the mind in this remembering, this five, this remembering part five samadhi. Prabhupada calls this lifeless yoga. But Srila Jiva Goswami says that the Lord enters our consciousness through the pathway of our remembrance. Because we're making this effort, therefore the Lord comes. So then the fourth part is samadhi, actual samadhi. This is the entering of the Ladini Shakti into our heart and what Prabhupada calls spiritual television. This is when the Lord's pastimes is actually happening in the heart. Now, this is not... Mental samadhi doesn't turn into spiritual samadhi. We can think of spiritual samadhi like you're putting sugar in the cooked down milk. It's a different type of samadhi. The mental samadhi is attracting the Ladini potency to come. And then perfection is when the Lord comes out of the heart and he's standing in front of you face to face. Who did this happen to in the Bhagavatam?
Dhruva Maharaj.
So he attained samadhi, then he attained spiritual samadhi, and then the Lord left his heart and was coming in front of him face to face. Prabhupada talks about in this purport the five rasas, the five relationships with Krishna. And he talks about how that any of us can attain any of these relationships according to our taste or our desire. Okay, so we talked about offensive clearing and pure stage and devotional service and spontaneous love, which is text 8. All right, now we're going to be finishing up the verses together. Of all the worlds, Radha's Kund is most blessed. Karmis to Bhaktas, her prema is best. Serve her and her Kund, Lord Krishna, you'll meet. By the way, if you see some things that don't rhyme, it's because when they're all put together, the rhyme is there. Just when we're looking at them individually. Yeah. Okay. So remember that Srila Rupa Goswami had promised us in text 7 and 8 that if we're absorbed in the Lord's name, form, qualities, and pastimes, we will live in the spiritual world. He said you'll essentially be living in Vrindavan. So this is not just better and best, but this is relevant to our meditation. Because here in text 8 we've moved from Vaidhi Sadhana to Raganuga Sadhana. And part of Raganuga Sadhana is you meditate on the personalities and the place that's in line with your own aspiration. So therefore, Srila Rupa Goswami is giving us these different places and these different persons. So he's saying there's Vaikuntha, right? There's Mathura, there's Vrindavan, there's Govardhan, and there's Radhakund. So in Vaikuntha, there's no Ragatmaka Bhaktis. Bhaktas. There's no one there in spontaneous devotion. They're perfected Vaidhi Bhaktas. And in Mathura, there's some. In Vrindavan, there's many. In Govardhan, more confidential. And in Radhakund, most confidential. Now, these gradations of places is based on the consciousness of the people. We have kind of an idea in this world, you know, that there's creatures that are suited to live in the desert that live in the desert, and creatures suited to live in the ocean that live in the ocean, and creatures suited for living in freshwater live in freshwater, like that. Creatures suitable for living in air live in the air. So in the ultimate realms, it's also like that. Depending on a person's mentality and desires, there's realms just suited for that. Yes. So this is still Raganuga Sadhana. Sadhana means a practice. So how we can meditate on those persons once we've awakened in our, as Prabhupada says, we have get some idea of our relationship with Krishna, then we meditate on that. And in verse 11, those who are at Radhakund are the most blessed. So here we have a hierarchy of places, a hierarchy of people. In verse 10, we are told to meditate on Krishna's eightfold daily pastimes. Now I find it fascinating that although Srila Prabhupada translated the Upadeshamrita and says specifically in the verse that we should meditate on the Astakalila Lila, I don't know of any place in Srila Prabhupada's books where he explains what the Astakalila Lila is. So I find that quite interesting. There's several books that describe Astakalila Lila, but Srila Prabhupada never translated any of them. And there's no place in his books where he describes exactly what that is, what those pastimes are. And that we do that ultimately then in meditating on our spiritual body and then attaining our spiritual body. So here's our hierarchy of places, Vaikuntha, Mathura, Vrindavan, Govardhan, Radhakund, and our hierarchy of people, Karmis, Gyanis, Muktis, Bhaktas, Prema Bhaktas, Gopis, and Radha, that we should serve Radha in her and her kund to attain one of the five relationships. This is actually a painting that we had commissioned for Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha. This is for verse 3. And the we have depicted here the leaders in each of the five rasas as described by our acharyas. So, like there's Rakhak and Patrak, etc. So there's the leaders of each of the five relationships are in this painting. All right, now we have the whole thing, and now you'll see how the rhymes work. Okay, you ready? Senses and mind in Lord Krishna's... Senses and mind in Lord's service we use. Hindrance avoid while good help we do choose. Loving exchange with the Vaishnavs are six. No Vaishnavs three and how with them we mix. Based on their faith and not their body's hues. Name may seem bitter, but taste is so sweet. Chant and remember the whole day complete. Of all the worlds, Radha's kund is most blessed. Karmis to Bhaktas, her prema is best. Serve her and her kund, Lord Krishna, you'll meet. So you see here we have complete and meet, and right, use and choose. So that wasn't so obvious when we broke it up. All right. Any questions or discussions on Upadesha Amrita? Yes.
Sometimes when we have this confidential talks, some people might have gone through grief, and that might burden other people who's hearing. It always, this can it always, how can it be enriching?
Are you? Do you want to talk from the point of view of the person speaking or the point of view of the person hearing?
Hearing.
Okay, from the point of view of the person hearing, we can always understand that everything everyone is doing at every moment is an attempt to experience rasa. Yes, everything everyone's doing at every moment, they're trying to find Krishna, they're trying to experience rasa. They're just going about it in the wrong way. And if you study all the 12 rasas, the 5 primary and the 7 secondary rasas, so there's Karuna Ras. Karuna Ras is lamentation and compassion. That's enjoyable. Why do people go to sad movies? They go to sad movies to enjoy them. Well, we learned that when we were 5 or 6. Happy, sad. Those are opposites. Why are people paying money to be sad? You know, was that a good movie? Oh, it was great. You can enjoy sadness. You felt? You can enjoy fear. Do people go on, like, you know, amusement park rides to enjoy fear? You can enjoy anger. That's why people watch sports. Why do people watch sports? They're trying to enjoy anger and chivalry. That's why they go to political rallies. To enjoy anger. and discussed even. Are there, you know, there's horror movies that people watch in order to be disgusted. Strange, isn't it? And you'll notice, you know, if you say to someone, "Ew, that's disgusting. Oh, what is it? Let me see." Someone's trying to enjoy those rasas. And you can see they're looking for Krishna. Maybe they're looking in the wrong way. But you could always connect that someone's looking for Krishna. Try to connect on that level rather than on this. If you, that way you don't take in their external, superficial, negative energy.
And what if while I'm sharing, let's say, if I'm in grief and then I share, so it's like, am I searching for Krishna? So, I mean, I should not burden other people who's hearing just by me pouring out whatever.
Be careful. You know, I mean, if we've gone through some kind of catastrophe, we may not be able to do anything else but deal with our catastrophe in that moment. But we should also have some consideration of other people. And if you're going through an ongoing catastrophe for 20 years, something's funny. Especially if it's the same catastrophe. That's not fair. Like I had a person who was asking me for the same, you know, advice on about the same thing over and over and over and over and over. And finally I said, look, why don't you make a spreadsheet of the things you've asked my advice on? And then that's one column. The next column is my suggestion. Then the next column is what you've actually done to try to put that into effect. And then the next column, what the result has been. And show that to me. And if you've actually done all that and none of it's worked, then we can go on from there. And then I never heard from this person again. So don't be a vacuum cleaner. You know, if pay attention. If you're going crying to somebody about the same problem over and 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 over, and you don't actually try to put into effect anything that they're suggesting, then you're taking something that's not your quota. You're taking their time and energy that's not yours to take. That's not fair. And then you're actually looking for something else. You know, maybe you just want someone to love you or something. You know, just there's some unmet need. There's something out of balance. If we're doing that, and we should try to be aware that we're doing that. But, I mean, there are some terrible catastrophes in life. And that's okay. You know. But then we should, again, be honest. We should say, I'm sorry, I'm falling apart. Does that make sense? I mean, I have one of my, Devesh's older brother, died about a year ago, last January. And I had 10 days when I was not able to do, I was just could not be an emotionally, I had no EQ for 10 days, let's just put it that way. Just like zero. I didn't have any. But I would tell people that. I'd say, I'm really sorry. I don't know what you're feeling or anything, and I don't even know what I'm feeling, and I can't have a normal emotional relationship with anybody right now. And then some people would say, oh, I understand. And then I would say, no, you don't. And I'd say, I hope you never understand. And I was probably really nasty, and I was incapable of having any kind of social, I just couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. But if you're like that long term, then you need to look at, do you follow? Some occasional terrible crisis. That's sometimes.
So, Mataji, how to draw a balance with these principles that sometimes when we unfold our needs and desires, and then there's this battle which we feel that do we need it or do we do we want it? So, where to understand or
are you looking back at the like too much and the wrong kind? Okay.
Yes. So, because when I just got married, I was like given a training that now you should plan for your one first step. This is the right time. And that was something...
What?
No, but that was something given to that...
On your wedding day?
After a month.
After a month?
Yes. But that, but
did you get married when you were 49 and a half years old?
No, that was a very good way. He told us that this is the time when you can look forward and you can plan your things so that you're not lost. That's why.
I see. Okay. I was kind of worried about this for a while.
No, he meant in a very good way.
Okay.
Just have that in the mind, he said, and okay. Look forward. So sometimes I just can't draw that balance, what is needed and what I want, and like how to approach it. That how much is important, how much is enough, like the desires keep on building. When I go deeper, I feel I'm not understanding what are the needs and what are the...
It depends on what your service is. You know, you have to, I mean, I talk about this in career dharma, like with the prosperity types. You know, each of us needs a different type and mixture of prosperity in order to feel satisfied in life. And that's, we need our type of food. You know, and we need different amounts. You know, my 16-year-old grandson can eat a lot more than I can eat. You know, we were at Govinda's and he went and got the ice cream sundae. And I couldn't even look at it. And just be could eat it. But for him, that's not too much. For me, that's too much. For him, that's not too much. So, you know, how old are you? How big is your body? How much physical work are you doing? And then some of us can digest certain types of food better than others. I mean, that just depends. What do I need? And that's true also, you know, how much stuff do you need? That's different for different people. Yeah. I once asked someone, why do some people have thousands of shalagrams? And they looked at me and said, why do some people have thousands of books? And I went, oh, okay. But it's different. You know, I go to some people's houses and there's 3 books. And I think, how do they live? I can't even imagine. So this is, we're different. What do you need to be able to function? Like Prabhupada says, we're each a cell in the universal body. You know, what the brain cells need is different than what the heart muscle needs, and different what the stomach muscle needs. You have to see, what do I need? And that's not selfish. If I'm part of Krishna, I have to get what I need in order to contribute properly to the society. And sometimes, you know, as far as the ashrams, that changes in time. You know, what I need when I'm 20, or what you need, you know, when you're 20 or 25 and married for 1 month is different than what you're going to need when you're 50 and ready to take vanapras, just by the way. So I was in the grahastha ashram for 23 years and I've been in the vanaprastha ashram 28 years now. So my needs are very different. You know, when I was a young grahastha, then I needed colorful, I had more clothes and they were colorful and I had jewelry and I needed that. I actually needed that. But I don't need that anymore. I'm trying to remember what I'm wearing today. I don't even know. I have 3 saris and the difference is just the border color, so I have to actually look. It doesn't matter to me anymore. That wouldn't have worked when I was 23 years old. Does that make sense?
Yes.
But also I just see, like, we have different levels of vairagya. I tell people, when you marry someone with the same level of vairagya. Like, to me, too much stuff, always, even when I was younger, too much stuff to me is a burden. I don't like having stuff. And other people living the way that I live, they'd go crazy. They're like, where's my stuff? So it's, and then what varna are you in? That also makes a difference. What kind of work do you do? I mean, like my granddaughter does carpentry, so she has a whole carpentry workshop with all these tools, hand tools, power tools. She has this huge saw and this beveling thing and this. And I don't need any of that. What would I do with it? I don't even know how to use it. I don't even care. I don't want to make chairs and desks. Does that make sense? You know?
Mataji, how to learn to respect the needs of the different people's different needs, how to respect that, to keep harmony there close to us, and we don't like each other's need, especially nowadays teenagers, they sleep very late at night, they like onion and garlic.
Well, that's not needs.
These are their needs and
life. No, that's not needs. That's not neat. So you're talking about two different things. First of all, respect others, that everybody's an individual. And I can't impose my particular psychology on others. That just doesn't work. It's not real. Some people like to read 6 hours a day. Some people, anything more than 15 minutes a day is a burden. Some people love to go on pilgrimage to all the holy places. And I mean, I look at people, when I was just in Vrindavan and Karthik, there's like 8,000, 10,000 people going on pilgrimage in all these buses, and I look at it and go, ah, no! And they're flying internationally and paying thousands of dollars for tickets to do something that I just like, can I just go to a place with like 3 people? So that's a difference in nature and a difference in personality. And that we respect because Krishna loves variety. Do you follow? Krishna likes variety. He doesn't want everyone to be just like me. That would be awful. He doesn't want everyone to be just like you. He loves you for you and he loves me for me. But he doesn't want everyone to be you and he doesn't want everyone to be me. So you can have, you know, 20 very serious, very advanced devotees who have different areas of taste and different services they do. And according to their different services, they may have different requirements. They may have different health and bodily requirements. They may have different psychological requirements. All right, now, the other thing you're talking about is a person's situation in the gunas and their commitment to Krishna consciousness. How can you respect that different people have different degrees of seriousness in Krishna consciousness and different association with the gunas? Well, because they do. And that's talking about something different. That's talking about levels of advancement. But people are as advanced as they are because they are. It doesn't do any good to not accept that. Now, you can decide what you'll allow in your house. If it's your house. Right? So if it's your house, you can say, there's no onion garlic in my house. Sorry, we don't let that here. Like you can say, there's no smoking in my house. But you can't dictate to someone else what their level of commitment to spiritual life is and what mode of nature they're in. That would be easy, you know. Be a pure devotee! You know, that just doesn't work. It doesn't work for you either. Like, I can't force you to be more advanced than you are. Have you tried forcing yourself to be more advanced than you are? Does it work? It doesn't work. You've never done that? Well, that's good. You're smart. But any of us, if we've tried to force ourselves to be more advanced than we are, it doesn't work. Yes?
Yes.
It just doesn't work. We are who we are at that particular level. So I don't see that there's an option of accepting that people are where they are. But again, you can make rules for your home. If you've got minor children living in your home, you're the adult. And if you have grown children living in your home, then you have to work out with them what kind of arrangement you want, like you'd arrange with any other adult, especially if they're not paying rent. But even if they're paying rent, even if you had somebody paying rent in your house, you'd still would have rules for your house. Am I correct? Am I correct? So just because someone is your biological child, if they're a fully grown, mature adult, doesn't mean that they can do whatever they want in your house. And if you let them do that, then the only person who's responsible for that is you. So if you let fully grown adults, whether they're biologically related to you or not, live in your house and do whatever they please, and then you complain about it, it doesn't make much sense. So if they're minor children that you're maintaining, you can set the rules. You say, these are the rules, this is our house, this is the rules in our house. And if they're fully grown adults, then you can have the rules like you'd have for any fully grown adult who wanted to stay in your house. And if you choose to let fully grown adults stay in your house because they're biologically related to you and then do all kinds of things that you don't like, you're choosing that. And to then get angry at those people is not fair. But everyone has free will to choose what they're going to choose in life. It's getting late. Yeah. We started a little late, but it's definitely getting late. All right, thank you very, very much. I hope this was helpful. Thank you, everybody online. Right. Oh, I was supposed to pass around the mic, but I didn't. And you didn't remind. It's all your fault. You didn't remind. I completely forgot.
So that was a very enlivening and very deep session. I wrote quite.